Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, Kate Moore on a fight for workers' justice in The Radium Girls. Kate Moore is a Sunday Times best-selling writer with more than a decade's experience in writing across varying genres, including memoir and biography and history. She is the author of The Radium Girls, which we're going to be talking about today, and previously she was the director of a critically acclaimed play about the Radium Girls called These Shining Lives. Kate, thank you for coming on to Little Atoms to talk to me about it.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So I want to talk about that play first. So, yeah, you directed this play, These Shining Lives. How did that come about?
So it came about because I'd actually only ever directed one play before and totally got the bug of directing. So about a week after the Get Out, I was Googling, thinking I want to find my next play. So I Googled great plays for women because I like to do plays with strong female characters and, you know, that focus on female storylines and that sort of thing. And this play, These Shining Lives by Melanie Marnick, came up. And I kind of tracked it down online, read a little bit what it was about, ordered it. And the moment I read the opening monologue, I said, this is the next play I want to direct. Because the story is just so incredible. It tells the story of the Radium Girls, who are the women from 1920s America who were poisoned with their work with radium. And they fought for justice because their companies refused to admit responsibility for killing them. And they, you know, stood up for their rights and they didn't kind of take it lying down. And that's what the play's about.
Did you know anything of that story before you saw the play?
Essentially, no. I think it kind of rang a vague bell, which I think when people hear about the Radium Girls, sometimes they've got a vague idea that it was some women that were hurt and that sort of thing. But I knew nothing other than that until I read the play.
So how did you then go about translating that into a book? How did you research it? Who did you talk to? Because obviously, as you said, this is all taking place at the beginning of the 20th century.
Yeah. So how the book came about was because I wanted my production of the play to be authentic. I read everything I could about them. And there are two books that talk about what the women have been through before. One of them's called Radium Girls, Industrial Health Reform, by Claudia
Exciting
Clark.
Exactly.
And as it suggests, it's a quite dry, you know, it started life as her dissertation. And it's a very dry book about the legal changes that their fight for justice brought about. And the other one, again, there's a couple of chapters on the women, but it's looking more about radium in general. And I just think, you know, I could tell it's an incredible story, and it seemed amazing that there was no book that focused on the women and told this story from their perspective, because they're the ones that got hurt, they're the ones that fought for justice and, you know, had that courage inside themselves to stand up for what they believed in. And it just seemed amazing that there was no book that did it, and I thought, well, if there isn't a book, why don't I write it? And that's how it came about.
So who did you speak to?
So I did a lot of research. I went to America for about a month and travelled round. You know, the book focuses on dial painters in New Jersey and dial painters in Illinois. So I went to both those places and also Washington, D.C. I tracked down the women's families. So I got to interview sons, daughters, nieces, nephews of the dial painters, because what I really wanted to do with this book was to bring the women to life. So I wanted to speak to their relatives to find out who they really were, because, of course, their relatives knew them best. Their relatives had sometimes been there when they were enduring all of this stuff. And so I wanted to find out what it was really like to be in their sick rooms, to know who they were.
Let's start at the beginning then with, I guess we should talk about radium itself, yes. First of all. So, of course, as I said, the majority of this story takes place in like the 20s and the 30s. Radium itself is something that has only recently been, obviously, you know, the Curies are, you know, big characters in this discovery and the first people to study it. It's this incredible, mysterious thing. We don't know much about it. It's got incredible properties. And obviously, of course, we have no idea at that point how dangerous it is. So tell us something about what radium is.
Well, so radium is a highly radioactive, luminous element. On the periodic table, it's in the alkali earth group of metals. Mm-hmm. And the way the girls were using it was as kind of radium salts, radium powder, and they'd mix the radium powder with some other ingredients to make this paint that would glow in the dark, which is what they were doing, painting the dials, so the dials would glow in the dark. And you say we didn't know it was dangerous, but actually very early on, the Curies themselves realised it was dangerous. You know, in 1903, so way before dial painting started in the First World War, Pierre Curie said, you know, if he was in it, he wouldn't dare trust himself to be in a room with a kilo of pure radium because it would probably burn all the skin off his body, destroy his eyesight and probably kill him. So people knew it was dangerous, and people that were working with large amounts, kind of war protective lead aprons, they weren't allowed to pick it up. They had to use kind of ivory tipped tongs. So it was known that it was dangerous, but it was an incredibly lucrative and mysterious element. So what happened was radium firms who kind of jumped on the bandwagon of this alluring, exciting new element that was hailed as the greatest find in history, they started conducting their own research, and they thought, well, okay, big amounts can kill you and hurt you and burn you, but how about we look at small amounts? And so they did their research, they funded the research, they produced journals, they set up radium clinics, which were kind of like spas. And the radium company said, we think small amounts of radium are beneficial. And so this huge radium industry sprang up. So radium was put in cosmetics, it was put in butter and milk and toothpaste. It was sold as a cure-all, so whether you had hay fever or gout or constipation or impotence, you were sold radioactive dressings and pills. And you could buy this. So this was the world in which the dial painters, the radium girls, began work. Radium was seen as this amazing cure-all. It was a wonder drug, basically.
And, well, that scene of Pierre Curie stood in a room with a kilogram of radium.
Yeah.
It's not something that would ever likely happen.
No.
And what we're talking about these girls using, as you said, they're talking about like very, very minuscule
tiny amounts,
unbelievably tiny amounts. You say right at the end of the book, I think you say that in the entire Second World War, the industry that was using radium to paint on dials, which is what these girls were doing, used something like 130 grams, the entire industry.
Yeah.
So we are talking about tiny amounts.
Yeah, micrograms, you know, really, really, really small amounts. But the problem was, and the thing the girls had to experience, so as I say, the radium industry said radium was good and there was this lucrative industry. So when the girls started to get sick and people kind of made the connection that it was these tiny amounts of radium that were hurting them rather than putting rosy cheeks on them and, you know, giving them health, the radium companies really fought back because they didn't want to make those connections. But the problem was because and this is another thing to talk about, because the girls were lip pointing, so they used to put their paintbrushes between their lips to make a fine point because the dials were so detailed and delicate to paint. The women were ingesting the radium. And so what was happening was the radium was settling in their bones. So it was right next to their bone marrow, causing, you know, extensive damage. And the fact was, it didn't matter how small the amount of radium was, once it was inside you, it caused thousands of times more damage than it did outside you. Mm-hmm. You know, Pierre Curie says a kilo would, you know, kill him. Well, inside the women, it could only have to be a kind of microgram, and it would cause damage thousands more times greater than that Pierre Curie talked about.
Well, let's take a step back, and we're going to come back to all those points in more detail in a moment. But these companies, so there's a couple of companies particularly that you talk about, Radium Dial in Illinois, a place called Ottawa, Illinois, and the United States Radium Corporation, which is in a couple of places in New Jersey.
Yeah.
So what are they doing? Let's talk about what those... Because you said there is this massive radium industry.
Yeah.
Obviously, somebody's got to produce radium. Somebody's putting radium in crazy health tonics and stuff. But what are these companies doing in these sites?
Okay, so the United States Radium Corporation, look at them first. So that was a huge firm. So they did extraction of radium, which was an incredibly costly process, kind of, you know, from a whole ton of ore, basically, you get radium from pitch blende ore. You would only get an amount of radium that's kind of 5 to 7 milligrams, which is about the size of the head of a pin. So that's from a whole ton of ore. It's an incredibly costly process. So they were doing that, refining it in the labs and that and so on. But they were also doing the dial painting, which is where the Radium Girls were involved, which is what I talk about in the book. And in the dial painting studios, what the women were doing was painting the numbers on watches, clocks, aeronautical dials to make them glow in the dark. And in Radium Dial was focused purely on the dial painting side, but it was a subsidiary of a much larger company called Standard Chemical, which did all the things that I've just talked about in terms of extraction.
Let's talk about how those studios work. So these girls were employed in these... I've got to sort of drift between describing it as a factory and a studio. It was more like an artist studio.
It was, it was seen as a very artistic job. You can imagine it's painting and it's very detailed, fine work. It was an amazing job. They felt they were lucky to get it because it was incredibly lucrative. The women weren't salaried. They were paid by the number of watches they painted. So they obviously had an impetus to paint as many watches as they could. And there was an amazing camaraderie between the women as well. That was what was nice about it. It was, you know, hundreds of women, you know, particularly during the war when they were kind of working 7 days a week and through the night. It was very young women, kind of teenagers. And it was this fun place to work.
Yeah, it has to be said, it seems like really fun.
Really fun place to work. You know, basically the girls would get covered in the dust from this radium powder, so they themselves would glow. So they would wear their good dresses to the plant so that when they went out dancing later, they'd be there kind of twizzling around in these kind of glorious glowing dresses. And, you know, some of them used the paint for fun, so they would paint it on their teeth. They wanted a kind of glow-in-the-dark smile, or they'd kind of have fun and paint moustaches and, you know, kind of funny faces on themselves and then turn out the lights in the dark room so that all you could see is these kind of glowing moustaches and things.
At the end of each working day, they would go into this room, this dark room, and basically have to be
brushed
cleaned
down.
Off of,
yeah,
the, that, of that's the radium what, so they could reuse it.
That's what happened in New Jersey because it was so expensive. And to put that in context, radium in 1917 cost essentially the equivalent today of $2.2 million for a single gram. That's how expensive it was. It was the most costly element on Earth. So yes, the girls got covered in the dust, and in New Jersey they would brush them down each night to try and get this very valuable material that they were covered in off them so they could reuse it.
I'm Eric Schlosser, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This is not the story of radium. This is the story of these particular women and
exactly.
What happened to them.
Yes.
So introduce us to some of the women that were working in... We'll talk about the story of what happens in New Jersey first, and then we'll come back to Ottawa later on. But introduce us to some of the women that were working in the New Jersey plant.
Well, as you say, absolutely, what I wanted to do with this book is focus on the girls because... in my opinion, they've kind of been forgotten. You know, the Radium Girls is this anonymous moniker, and we've forgotten the individuals. Mm-hmm. And what the book does is focus on their individual journeys and what they individually suffered and achieved. So in New Jersey, Grace Fryer is one of the girls who was absolutely central to this story and this fight for justice that the girls had. And she was 18 when she started work there, very intelligent young woman. After she dial painted, after the war ended, she went and worked in a bank and was kind of head of her department. She came from quite a political family, so her dad was a union rep, and she herself kind of talks about going out to vote once women get the vote. And I think that's another really interesting thing about this story. At the time the girls were painting, it was a time of female empowerment. They were getting the vote. They were having their jobs for the first time. And dial painters actually out-earned their fathers sometimes because they were in the top 5% of female wage earners. So... that's Grace, beautiful, absolutely stunning. You know, there's some pictures in the book, absolutely stunning young woman and incredibly bright as well. Catherine Sharp is another of the dial painters in New Jersey. She wanted to be an author when she grew up. That's what she longed to do. And she actually worked with some of her relatives. So her cousin Irene was another dial painter mm-hmm. there. And then another kind of two groups I just want to mention is sets of sisters.
Yeah.
Because what happened in both places, in Illinois and New Jersey, is because the job was seen as this amazing job where it was glamorous and artistic and lucrative, lots of the girls said to their sisters and cousins and friends, come and join us at the dial painting studio. This is a wonderful job. And so you had whole sets of siblings working alongside each other, lip pointing their brushes. And so the book also focuses on Sarah and Marguerite Carlo, and also on the Maggia sisters, who were Italian immigrant sisters, Molly, Quinta and Albina.
And well, we'll talk about, I guess, Molly in some detail first of all, because I want to talk about when it first becomes apparent that there's something wrong. And a key thing to point out here is often, although we'll see in Molly's case that it comes relatively quickly. Mm. In a lot of these cases, it takes quite a while for radium to sort of manifest itself as bad. And that's obviously quite important as we get to look at some of the legal trials later on.
Yeah.
And of course, some of these people might only work there for a month or work there for a few weeks. Some of them work there for years.
Yeah.
And it really makes no difference how long they actually work there, as you pointed out, once it gets inside them. So what are the first signs that there's something wrong?
Well, the women started to feel run down generally. A lot of them, they found it started in their teeth. So they'd have a toothache, they'd go to the dentist would pull the tooth and it wouldn't heal. Instead, their kind of gum would get infected and then the next tooth would start to hurt and then that would be pulled out and then that would get infected as well. Other women found that it started in their limbs, so they'd have an aching arm or an aching leg. And some of them found that their legs started shortening.
Mm-hmm.
So before, obviously, they had legs that measured up straight, but the women's legs over time started shortening, you know, some by as much as kind of 4 inches shorter in the end.
We'll talk about what happens to Molly.
Yeah.
I think I'm right in saying that she was the first
person to die.
Let's talk about this in, I guess, really excruciating detail, because what happens to her is, it's so shocking, horrible. This, either their suffering and the eventual death in both cases is really appalling. So tell us everything that happens to Molly.
So Molly was 23 at the time this started happening to her, so she should have been in good health.
Yeah, all of these women are really young.
Really young, again, because they're teenagers, most of them, when they start
painting. Some of them are 14 when they started their job.
So with Molly, started with a toothache. And as I say, she went to the dentist, it pulled, it didn't get better. And so she went to try another dentist and he tries the same thing and no one can cure her, basically. So what starts happening, the dentists start pulling all her teeth, so her teeth are coming out. And as I say, her gums don't heal, so she's left with these ulcers. And, you know, they talk about the fact that essentially her whole mouth and almost kind of up to her head and the roof of her mouth becomes like an abscess, one huge abscess. And anyone that's had a tooth abscess knows how painful that is. And her whole mouth was like that. And as I say, everything was infected. So her teeth were getting kind of flinty and moth-eaten. So the bones kind of had holes in them, which was from the radium drilling into them. And what happened was, even once her teeth had gone and her gums were infected, the radium was attacking her jaw bones. And so what happens to Molly is, she goes to the dentist one day and she kind of says, you know, it's really sore along my jaw. And so the dentist probes at her jaw and it breaks against his fingers and he can lift out her entire lower jawbone without an operation, just picks it out because it's fractured inside her. And basically, she gets sicker and sicker and sicker, and it's not just in her mouth anymore. She starts limping. Doctors think it's rheumatism. They send her home with aspirin. That's what they think will cure her. And they start testing her because it's obviously some infection that's getting worse and worse and worse. So they try various tests. They test her for syphilis because some of her symptoms, you could say, you know, joint pain and so on. And in Molly's case, she actually lived outside her family home, so she was an unmarried young woman who lived in a female boarding house. And I think it's my kind of perception that perhaps they looked at that and thought this is a good thing to test her for. But it came back negative, so they keep testing, and Molly's getting, You know, her whole body is aching now. As I say, her jawbone's gone. Her mouth is full of abscesses and she starts bleeding at the jaw. They test her again for syphilis, but it's her dentist that tests her, doesn't really know what he's doing with the test. I think he basically gets mixed up, is what we think happened. And the test then comes back as positive, so they think she's got syphilis. And Molly dies on the 12th of September 1922 with a hemorrhage from the jaw that they can't staunch. So the blood just kind of fills her mouth, fills her jaw, spills over her, and they can't stop it. And that's how she dies, age 24.
And that's about as appalling a death as I could imagine, yeah. Really. But then to sort of compound that misery, they do basically decide that she's died from syphilis.
Yeah, and that myth is perpetuated and then seized on once the girls try and start fighting back, because obviously more of them start getting sick and they're trying to make the link between their work and the illnesses that all these young women are suffering. But the radium firms keep saying, well, Molly died of syphilis, you know. And that kind of, you know, you can imagine all that association, you know, a sexually transmitted disease, and the firms really try to discredit the women and their families. And this mixed up test result was perpetuated for years, that they said that's what she died of.
Now, this is not the end of Molly's part in this story, is
no,
it?
No. So, as I say, Molly worked alongside her sisters, Quinta and Albina. And Quinta and Albina are two of the five women who are part of this central court case against the radium firm in New Jersey. And as they're trying to gather evidence, they actually exhume Molly and they test her, and they find that radium is throughout her entire body and there is absolutely no sign of syphilis.
There's this particular sort of macabre scene where they do the exhumation,
yeah.
And she's basically glowing when they
glowing in her coffins, because what was happening, as I say, the radium was settling in the girl's bones and it's impossible to remove once it's in there. And radium is a luminous element. That's why they were using it to create these luminous dials. And so once it settled in their bones, that's what people said. They said the girl's bones actually glowed. So when they opened Molly's coffin, it was aglow with the soft luminescence of radium compounds, is what they said. But also the girls, when they were alive, were glowing. Catherine Donahue's nephew said to me, you could see every bone in her body when she was just lying on the bed in a darkened room. That's what happened to them.
Let's talk about what starts happening to some of the other women then. Mm. So Molly's died relatively quickly.
Yes.
Some of these women continue living for a number of years afterwards. Yes. But they all start to get often like different symptoms.
Yeah, which was one of the confusing things. So obviously the radium firms don't want to make any link with radium. Mm. And what makes it hard for the girls, you've mentioned that it's an insidious poisoning, so it takes many years to manifest itself. So most of the girls are no longer dial painting. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of saying, well, how can you say it's your work? You haven't worked here for 5 years. And the other thing was they felt the radium in different parts of their body. So in one woman, you know, in Quinta kind of felt it in her hips. Grace Fryer felt it in her spine. In Catherine Sharp, it was her teeth that she first felt it in. And so it was very hard for the doctors to actually kind of join the dots and say definitively, yes, this is it. But one of the things I find really shocking about the story is the Department of Labour in New Jersey start looking into these deaths of these young women, and they send off the paint to a consulting chemist. And in January 1923, so this is only a few months after Molly has died, he says it's the radium that's mm-hmm. caused it. But, you know, the whole book goes on to almost the 1940s, so it takes that long mm-hmm. for anyone to actually do anything about it. And that's the thing for me that still enrages me. You just think, they knew, someone official said, January 1923, it's the radium, and more women got hurt.
We've described obviously what happened to Molly and about her jaw, but now we've established that, you know, spoiler alert, it definitely is the radium
yes.
that's doing this, even though no one's admitted to that yet. We'll get onto that in a minute. Describe again what it is that it's doing to them. Once they've ingested the radium, what is it doing to their bodies?
So basically, radium is chemically similar to calcium. So we all know, you know, you're supposed to drink milk because it's got calcium in it, and that goes into your bones and in your teeth and makes them really strong. And essentially, because radium is chemically similar to calcium, it acts in exactly the same way. So the body identifies radium and takes it straight to the bones and the teeth. But obviously, where calcium makes your bones strong, radium weakens it. So it literally bored holes in the women's bones. And as I say, the women felt it in different places, because it seemed to be that almost on a whim, as the radium was settling in their bones, it would kind of choose in a different woman, you know, where to go. So as I say, in some it was their spines, in some their hips, in others their legs, and so on. And that's what was happening. So there were holes being made in their bones while these women were still alive, and they found that sometimes their legs would break, kind of spontaneously fracture. So they'd just kind of stumble and the bone would break because it was so brittle and honeycombed with these holes in it.
Once we get to the second part of the show, I want to start us off looking at the first trial of the five women, that the five women bring, not of the five women, I should say. But up to that point, so let's talk about what the company is doing, right? There's obviously becomes a point where they know that it's the radium.
Yeah.
There's no doubt that it's the radium. And indeed, at least one of the founders of the New Jersey company is definitely, basically is manoeuvred out of the company, but is saying from the sidelines that it's definitely, definitely, definitely the radium. So what sort of manoeuvres are they doing to deflect the blame from themselves?
Well, they're completely trying to cover it up. So they do, the firm itself commissions this expert report from the drinkers, Cecil K. Drinker, who was part of Harvard School of Public Health. So, you know, a completely brilliant man, you know, a leader in his field. And so obviously the firm are bringing in the very best to identify what the problem is. And Drinker, very, as I say, brilliant man, makes the connection, says it's definitely radium, identifies that the radium's settling in their bones and that the damage is thousands of times greater than it would be outside. And the firm cover up the report. They literally, they suppress it for a year. They don't publish it. They don't tell anyone about it. And they start to try and hire their own experts. So they hire doctors who kind of weasel their way into treating the women, and these doctors who are being paid by the companies tell the girls, oh, you're in perfect health, you know, it can't possibly be the company that's hurt you. So it was a complete cover-up. As I say, they suppressed evidence, they tried to discredit the women, they foxed them with, you know, false doctors' diagnoses. These expert doctors that they were hiring were also then publishing reports.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Reports to say, oh, you know, it's just a kind of virus or something like that, you know, that's being passed around a single studio. So there was expert, I'm putting it in, you know, quote marks, expert evidence being published saying it can't be the radium, even though the firms had other reports that said it definitely was.
Well, I want to talk about one of those, again, expert, in double inverted commas in this particular case.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Dr., in inverted commas, Frederick Flynn. Who was he?
So he worked for Columbia University. He was an expert in industrial hygiene, and he was... It's a bit of a spoiler alert, but he was a doctor of philosophy, yet he was involved in testing the women medically, taking their blood, checking their x-rays. So he absolutely had no medical license whatsoever, and yet was treating them. And he was, you know, as you say, these doctors who were issuing reports. Mm-hmm. And he actually, what was really significant about his work, so he worked for lots of the different radium firms, so not just in New Jersey, but also for a clock company. So this clock company had started their own dial painting studio in Connecticut, and women at this clock company, Waterbury Clock Company, started dying as well. And Dr. Flynn knew about this, and yet still published his report that said it's just this studio in New Jersey that has the problem, even though he knew that there were other deaths. And obviously the fact there were other deaths in a completely different state proved that it was radium and that, you know, this was an occupational disease and it wasn't just a single studio that the women had been hurt in.
Yeah, listening to Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny, and today I'm talking to Kate Moore. We're talking about her book, The Radium Girls. And Kate, when we just finished the first part, we were talking about one of the definite villains of this of this story, Dr. Flynn. Mm. So let's start off the second part as we go towards the first big trial, talking about Raymond Berry, one of the heroes. Who was
he? So Raymond Berry was a young, only in his 20s, lawyer just out of Harvard. And he was the only lawyer that responded to Grace Fryer's request for help. So Grace was the dial painter that didn't give up. So basically, once the women had their formal diagnosis that it's definitely radium poisoning, which was given to them by this amazing doctor called Harrison Martland, immediately the girls thought, well, now we've got a doctor saying it's definitely radium, we can sue the firms. And they needed to sue the firms because these women were crippled, not just physically, but financially. I mean, many of them kind of lost their homes, their parents were impoverished, they were impoverished. So they absolutely needed to sue the companies, not just for money, but also to stop them hurting other women. But they couldn't find a lawyer to take the case. There was this legal problem with the statute of limitations, because with industrial hazards, you're supposed to, you know, sue your company as soon as possible after you've been hurt. But because radium poisoning takes several years to manifest, many of these women hadn't worked there for a long time. And the other thing was, it was such a new kind of poisoning, and because of Dr. Flynn's work in publishing things saying it wasn't radium, a lot of the lawyers were confused. They didn't know whether it was true. The firms, these big, powerful corporations that were very well connected in government, that had, you know, they were literally millions and millions of dollars. So a lot of lawyers didn't want to take them on because these companies were incredibly powerful. And so Raymond Berry was the only lawyer that Grace Fryer could find who would take their case, and he was brilliant.
Let's go towards the trial. One of the things that happens here is that certain elements of the press pick up on this story and start to publicise it.
So, I mean, as you can imagine, it's an incredible human interest story, shall we say. You know, these young, innocent women who've been destroyed by this radium, and they're fighting against their firms. And what was interesting is people kind of said their poisoning destroyed their very womanhood, because it was very disfiguring. You know, you can imagine they're losing all their teeth because of the kind of infection and the pus that was setting in around their mouths. A lot of their faces were very swollen. They were losing their jawbones. You know, they were having to wear steel back braces to keep themselves upright. And many of them suffered stillborn children or were made infertile from the radium poisoning. So from a press perspective, this was a very powerful story. So the press actually really got behind the girls and supported them. And one newspaper in particular, The World, which was at that time one of America's leading newspapers, particularly fighting for kind of working class people and, you know, the common man, that's what it did. And so they wrote a series of incredibly powerful and influential editorials where they were kind of saying justice is being denied and slating the radium firm for kind of trying to use legal trickery to kind of wriggle out of owning up to the fact that they'd hurt all these women.
And so there's this first trial, five women with Berry as their lawyer. Tell us about that trial.
So this trial, they originally sued in 1927, and the five women suing were Grace Fryer, Catherine Sharp, Quinta and Albina Maggia, and Edna Hussman, who was another dial painter who was affected. And it became a real cause célèbre, and as you say, the press interest was enormous. The women were literally internationally famous. You know, I kind of found letters in the archives, you know, from London, from Canada, from across the world. And it became such a cause célèbre, I think, because the women were so central to the story. They did a lot of interviews to try and get the story out there. And people really felt for them. They, you know, they fell for these incredibly powerful and lovely women, which is how they come across and how I've got to know them through their letters and diaries and the court transcripts and so on.
You tell the story of this trial and it's ups and downs and they get a settlement.
Yeah, which is, I think, part of the company's legal trickery.
Yeah.
Because, as I say, this case was huge, internationally famous. You know, day after day, the papers are saying this is unmanly, they said, about the Radium Corporations. You know, they're denying justice to these women who they were saying they might not live until September. You know, we've got to give justice to these poor women. And so the radium firms very cleverly settled the case.
And they don't, there's no sort of, they don't take any responsibility, basically.
No.
There's no judgment that says the company was to blame.
They say they're settling for humanitarian reasons. But what happens is it makes it all go away.
So those five women have got some sort of financial settlement, some sort of thing to pay their medical, you know, they're going to pay their medical bills.
Yeah.
And the settlement itself is quite interesting because the company ends up agreeing, in the first instance, they do try to wheedle out of it, but they end up agreeing to some quite unusual settlements.
So even at this point, the firms are not wanting to admit that radium is at fault, and they're, because, again, hugely lucrative industry, they're still making tons of money by selling their radium products. And so what they do, they say, OK, we'll pay you the money, but you've got to submit to these tests from this committee of doctors. And it's very clear, you know, Berry says in his correspondence, the company haven't even tried to hide what they're doing. The plan is that this committee of doctors, you know, some of whom are actually radium medicine specialists, so they're pro-radium, they're going to find the girls are not suffering from radium poisoning, and then we won't have to pay anymore. So the girls have to go through all these tests, even after the settlements, you know, colonic irrigations and trying all sorts of different treatments that make them sick. Luckily, the doctors don't say they're not suffering from radium poisoning, because they are. But that's the company's plan. It's a definite scheme to get out of paying.
And of course, this is a settlement for five women.
Yes.
And at some point, you know, there's over, I think, 200 women that have been employed in that one particular factory.
Even more than that,
So, obviously, there are a number of other women, and there are eventually other trials resulting from that one particular factory. But now let us go over to Illinois, a different company. Obviously, this has been big news, this trial.
Yeah.
So they will have heard of what's been going on over in New Jersey. So what effect does that have, if any?
So just to give a bit of kind of history of Ottawa, Illinois. So Ottawa, Illinois is a tiny town. It's in the middle of the Midwest, so far, far away from New York and New Jersey and you know, the eastern seaboard. And in Ottawa, it was literally 2 days after Molly Maggia's funeral that the advert went out, we want to hire girls to paint in this dial painting studio. And because radium poisoning takes years to manifest itself, the girls aren't getting sick at this point. But as you say, once this New Jersey trial happens, suddenly it's national news. And Catherine Wolfe, who is one of the key people in Ottawa, and her fellow dial painters, Marie Rossiter and so on, they see all this coverage that is saying radium paint is to blame. If you're a dial painter, you're going to get sick. And so they say to their firm, you know, oh my God, you know, that, you know, you can imagine, you know, Catherine talks about the chill of fear in the studio, that they could, you know, they scarcely talk, could scarcely work because they were so frightened. Because even though Catherine at that point had had a bit of a limp, didn't think much of it, she just thought, oh, I'm just a bit run down. But reading this, you suddenly think, hang on a sec. And what Radium Dial do in Ottawa is, first of all, they test the women, but they keep the test results secret. And then they publish a full-page advertisement in the local paper that assures the women that they're fine. They say, oh, we've had you tested by experts. There's been no sign or symptom of radium poisoning that we found. And they say, if we had any suspicion that the work could hurt you, we would have suspended operations immediately. But actually, that's not true, because Radium Dial knew about what was happening in New Jersey. You know, the radium industry was quite a small place, and they'd heard about the lawsuits quite early on, and they'd put some effort, they put a bit of effort into finding an alternative method of applying the paint. So Radium Dial knew early on that radium poisoning was a thing. They didn't tell their employees. They didn't stop lip pointing. The alternative methods they tried were not efficient, so they all went back to lip pointing. And now, when it's national news and the dial painters are finally saying, Mr. Reed, who's their boss in the studio, are the workers in danger? That's what Marie said to him. She demanded to know, are the workers in danger? And they said no, and they run this full-page advertisement over several days. And so the girls think, OK, must be OK. And what was happening, it gets a bit complex, but radium dials say the cases out east in New Jersey used a different kind of radium. So you're fine.
Now, one worker at that factory does die, and her family bring a lawsuit against the company, which fails.
Yeah.
Tell us how, because it's relevant to the later trial, how did the company basically defend that first lawsuit?
So in Illinois, the first big kind of trial with all the women getting behind the court case, and what I think is really special about the story is the way that the women all banded together. You know, these were groups of women suing because they kind of bonded together and did it together. Mm. It was very much about a united front. And Inez Vallet in Ottawa, Illinois, was the kind of lead case because essentially she was the one who was most sick at that time. They said she hobbled about like an old woman and her face was constantly seeping pus. So she was the woman that was the kind of lead litigant in this first case in Ottawa. And Radium Dial said, they kind of held their hands up and said, radium is a poison. But the law in Illinois at that time said that poisons weren't covered by the Occupational Diseases Act. And so it got thrown out on that reason, but also because the company said that the law was kind of unintelligible, that the wording was too vague and therefore it didn't merit something like a intelligible standard of conduct. And so essentially the courts agreed with them and they said, yeah, you know what, the law isn't worth the paper it's written on. Therefore, the girls lost their case.
I'm Greg Jenner, you're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So there's a later trial with some of the women from the Illinois factory, Catherine, Charlotte, Helen, Pearl. But at this point we should introduce another character, Len Grossman.
Len Grossman.
So who is he?
Len Grossman is an amazing man. So he was a lawyer, he was 46 at the time the girls came to him, and he essentially worked pro bono for them. And he was a man, his son, when I interviewed him, said, you know, he had a passion for the working people and those who were in need and needed help. Len Grossman is the kind of lawyer who his son remembered that, you know, he would take payment in shoes. If people didn't have enough money, he would take whatever they could give him. He worked because the cause was there and he wanted to fight for the cause and to help these people who were in need. And he was absolutely the kind of lawyer that the women needed because they had no money whatsoever and they needed a champion who would take on the case because it was the right thing to do because these companies had lied to the women and covered things up. And that's who Len Grossman was.
So there becomes a hearing. It's not a court, it's an industrial commission.
That's right,
hearing.
Yeah.
Len Grossman is going to represent these women.
Yeah.
Radium Dial are obviously going to defend this case again.
Yeah.
So one would presume that they're going to defend it by suggesting that, well, radium is a poison, mm-hmm. but the laws are all bad.
Yeah.
But they don't.
No, well, at this point, because of the Inez Vallet case, which obviously everyone can see that, you know, the company have totally got away with it scot-free, so the law was rewritten. So the law now says that poisons are covered by the Occupational Diseases Act. So you would say, yes, radium's a poison, that's exactly what the firm said last time, therefore they should be found at fault. Whereas now they say, radium's not a poison. They even say something like radium poisoning is just a phrase, it's kind of a useful way of summarising what's happening, but radium is, it's abrasive, but it's not a poison.
One of the women, Catherine Donoghue, who was, you tell the story of, and has become like, you know, increasingly ill, something appears in this hearing, makes a dramatic change, something that she brings in a little box.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Catherine, like many of the dial painters, felt the radium poisoning in her mouth quite early on and just as had happened to Molly Maggio, her jawbone started splintering. And so what Catherine brings into the courtroom in her little box are pieces of her jawbone, and she presents them to the court, and they enter into evidence.
This hearing, they win the hearing.
Yeah, which is the first time that a radium company is ever found at fault for killing the women, and this is in 1938. I mentioned earlier that the chemist kind of diagnosed it in 1923, so that's how long this battle has taken the women.
But of course they dispute that.
And yeah, this, the firms
they
dispute
appeal
it.
And they appeal,
yes,
and that
yeah.
obviously
yes,
goes
yeah.
on. Indeed, goes all yeah. the way to the Supreme Court.
Yes.
But in the end, Radium Dial Company are found
yeah.
guilty. The women are...
vindicated.
Vindicated indeed. Mm. But of course, radium was a death sentence for all of those women. There was nothing they could do about that.
No.
But let's spend the last part of the show talking about perhaps what their legacy was. They didn't die in vain. Things possibly changed, possibly didn't, which we'll come to again in a moment. Mm. But as you just said, this trial has just happened on the eve of World War II.
Yes.
We've already mentioned that radium was continued to be used for dials.
Yeah.
Obviously, again, well, we didn't really mention, I guess, for the First World War, but war obviously massively increases
demand,
the need for luminous dials in planes
yeah.
as well as watches. So what happens in the Second World War? How does the Air Force get its luminous dials in the Second World War?
Well, as you say, the women left a legacy, basically, because of Grace Fryer and Catherine Donoghue standing up, fighting these trials, you know, as did all their friends. Dial painting was the most feared occupation among young women. Obviously, they'd seen these national headlines. They'd seen these poor women. You know, Catherine Donoghue gave evidence on her deathbed, essentially, and people saw these pictures. And so the government couldn't sit idly by anymore and just not let anything happen. So they put safety standards in place to protect workers, which meant that the next kind of generation of dial painters, so the Second World War dial painters, didn't suffer the same horrific poisoning that these women suffered. And there were safety standards put in place, not just for radium dial painters, but actually when on the Manhattan Project, when they're building the atomic bomb, Glenn Seaborg was one of the kind of leading scientists who was in charge of the Manhattan Project. And he actually writes in his diary that as he's walking through the labs one night, he has this vision of the radium dial painters, of Grace, of Catherine and their friends, and the fact that they died. And so he immediately said, I think we need to do some research into plutonium. And it was found to be biomedically very similar to radium, meaning it would settle in the bones of anyone exposed to it. And so they put safety standards in place for the Manhattan Project, which were directly based on the radium safety standards, which were inspired by and instructed by the research that they'd done on the bodies of these original radium girls. So they protected thousands and thousands of workers.
And indeed, that research goes on. Obviously, you know, you mentioned the Manhattan Project. The Second World War was the dawning of the atomic age.
Yes.
And not only the remains of some of those women, but their family members were then used for research
yeah.
after the war.
But basically, these women are the only kind of source of people exposed to internal radiation that we have and had at that time. And so people wanted to know, in this atomic age, when there's nuclear tests going on, you know, there's the kind of arms race happening, so there's all these above-ground atomic tests that are going off, and people are doing tests and realising that those radioactive isotopes are getting into the human food chain and they're getting into our bodies across the world. And so they start looking at the girls, as you say, those who are still living, because radium poisoning can take so long, many of the girls actually lived for longer than you might expect. And so they tested them to find out, you know, is there a magic threshold at which point you can be exposed to radiation, or actually should we not increase the radioactivity of the human body at all, which is what they ultimately decided. But the girls are, you know, they were an incalculable resource. Basically, all the world's knowledge of radiation that we have comes from the radium girls. So they influence our lives, you know, they helped make sure that though the test ban treaty was signed, and they helped put safety standards in place for all the, you know, atomic industries that are still operating today. And also legally, they brought about changes as well. So with all their kind of fights for justice, there were kind of health and safety laws put in place for workplaces and so on. So they protected workers that way too.
This has been a you know, an incredibly inspiring story of, you know, intransigent companies from the past treating their workers bad and those workers being vindicated and leaving a fantastic legacy behind. And then right at the end of the book, there's a little page of description that on first glance seems like it might have been accidentally printed from earlier in the story, because it shows a scene in a radium dial factory in Ottawa in Illinois, a scene that's similar to Radium Dial, and in fact a place that's been set up by one of the guys that used to work at Radium Dial and has left.
He was the president, so he was absolutely in charge. Joseph Kelly, he's the name that signed his name to the advertisement that ran in the paper after the New Jersey trial that told the Ottawa women they were safe, so they kept working there. So this is the guy, and he gets booted out of Radium Dial because of the court cases and because he's poisoned all these women. There's kind of corporate wrangling going on. And he sets up this new firm, Luminous Processes.
And so this seems like a scene from the 1920s again, but it's in 1978.
It's in 1978.
So what happened?
So essentially, Joseph Kelly sets up this new firm. He tells the girls, as long as you don't lip point, you'll be fine. He obviously doesn't put into practice the safety standards that are operating in other dial painting studios elsewhere in the US. And safety standards are actually raised about this plant in Ottawa for decades. You know, I found official documents in the archives saying they'd been looked at in the 40s, in the 50s, in the 60s, and concerns had been raised. And I think that, you know, the company brushed them off and the inspectors clearly don't have any power to kind of shut them down. And it's not until it's the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, I think that's what they're called, the NRC, they, for some, you know, through some different wrangling, finally are in charge of looking at the safety standards in this factory in 1978. And they say, hang on a sec, this is ridiculous. I mean, the radiation levels were 1,666 times higher than was safe. And so they finally shut down this studio. And as you say, when you're reading the quotes from the women who were working there in this later time, it reads exactly like the quotes from earlier in the book about how much fun they're having, about the fact they'll paint their fingernails for kicks with the radioactive radium. Safety standards were completely lax. They were putting radioactive waste down the loos. The mind boggles, given what we know, what we knew even in 1978 about radium and radioactivity. But this firm got away with it. And the local paper says, Luminous Processes seems to put profits before people. And that's exactly what they were doing. And so another generation of women in Ottawa, Illinois, in exactly the same town, were hurt.
Now, obviously, as you just pointed out, they were found out and they were closed down. But I guess the moral of this story is with industrial standards for workers is eternal vigilance.
Yeah, and I think we have to be vigilant as a society as well, to be honest, to keep an eye on companies, because I personally think if they can get away with it, they will. You see that even today there are still deaths in workplaces. Companies will try and wriggle out of things if they can. So I think it's essential that we're inspired by the sacrifice, not only of the Radium Girls, but all workers and people who have died for our rights. You know, health and safety becomes a kind of a bit of a joke some of these days. But actually, what they achieve for us is amazing. We should all be grateful and, as you say, vigilant to make sure we stay safe.
That's a good point for us to finish then. So I've been talking to Kate Moore. We've been talking about her book, The Radium Girls, which is out now from Simon & Schuster. Kate, thank you so much for coming in and sharing it with us.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, or even a lot, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.